Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets, like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Welcome to the Edge of Sports podcast. I'm Dave Zirin. We are brought to you only by The Nation magazine. We are thrilled to have on the show this week two amazing guests. Later in the show, we'll be talking to the basketball savant, Arya Shirazi, about March Madness memories, when March was truly mad. But first, I'm so excited to have this guy on the show. You've heard me reference his research for years, if you're a regular listener to this podcast. The reports that he has done, particularly about gender and representation in the mainstream sports media, has been invaluable. He's a longtime teacher at USC, and he just published a book that's just coming out. It's really remarkable. It's called The High School, Sports, Spirit, and Citizens, 1903 to 2024. It's about his high school, Salinas High School, which I'm sure we're going to hear something about, and what we can learn about sports, and particularly gender in sports, but sports in general, and how we can chart societal changes by looking at the photos, yearbooks, what have you, from this period of 1903 to 2024. I haven't even said his name yet. It's Michael Messner. Michael, how are you doing, sir?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for having me. I'm just so happy to be on your show, and I'm so respectful of all the work that you do, Dave.
Oh, that's a total mutual admiration society then. I mean, you know, I said to you this over email, and I want to repeat it. This is such a great idea that I'm actually surprised that it's never been done before. Like, at least in sports, were you inspired at all by any sort of yearbook overview over time? Have you ever seen that before? And where did this idea to even do this book come to your head?
There have been a few other scholars who have drawn a little bit from yearbooks to supplement studies that they've done on histories of sports and or histories of schools and colleges and universities, high schools, but I don't think anybody has ever used 120 years of a school's yearbooks to chronicle change and continuity over time. So I think the idea is fairly unique. And, you know, the conception people say is brilliant. We'll wait to see if readers think the execution is equally good. But I'm pretty happy with it. It was a project of the head and the heart because, as you said, this was my high school. My father was a coach there for 25 years, starting in 1947, was a highly respected basketball coach. And I played for him on his team, 1968 to 1970. Both of my sisters went to school there. My older sister, Terry, was a head cheerleader in 1965. So I have a deep connection to the school. And when my father died relatively young in 1977, I inherited this big box of his yearbooks that were about 25, 26 years worth of yearbooks. And I had my own yearbooks as well. And they kind of just sat there for quite a while. And then around the year 2000, I pulled them out and started poking through them. And I thought, this is really interesting window into high school life, youth culture, sports, cheerleading. And if I were to go stretch all the way back to the first year that these yearbooks were made, 1903 at Salinas High School, and then run it to the present, I might have an interesting chronicle here. So then it took me about 20 years before I got around to it. But meantime, I started collecting books. And I now own about 100 of the 120 books from Salinas High School. And you may know, a lot of people may or may not know, Salinas is in coastal central California. It's a big agricultural town, so it has a long history of labor strife and labor movements. In 1934, a horrible strike in Salinas that was very violent. The 1960s, Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers were really active in organizing the Great Boycott in California, and Salinas was ground central for a lot of that organizing. And Salinas is also known for our most famous alum from Salinas High School, John Steinbeck, the great Nobel Prize winning novelist, who was the senior class president in 1919. And I couldn't buy the 1919 book because Steinbeck collectors have snapped them all up, and they're very, very expensive. But he also played on the basketball team, the track team, and he was in the student play, and was a very, very involved student there at Salinas High School. So his story is a thread that I run through the whole book, not just 1919, but his activism in the 1930s on behalf of farm workers and laborers. And then later, of course, some of his works from the 40s and 50s.
Yeah, now you mentioned some of this, but I mean, to me, 1903 compared to 2024, you might as well be talking about 1603. It feels like, I know you mentioned the labor piece, but what are some of the most broad-based significant changes, particularly in terms of demographics, that you see at Salinas High School over the course of that 120 years?
Well, early in the history of Salinas High School, at least from the time the first yearbook started coming out, 1903, the school and the town are fairly small. It's a predominantly Anglo town or Anglo school, I should say. There are a good number of Asian Americans living in Salinas during that time. They don't show up in the yearbook until a little bit later, but the largest non-white group early on at Salinas High School, running up from through the 30s to the 1940s, right up to the war, were Japanese Americans who came to Salinas to work in the fields and also in the nearby Spreckels sugar factory, and they were settled in Salinas, so a lot of their kids started going to the high school, and they were very integrated in the 30s and 40s into all aspects of student life, including sports. And one of the things that I think is really interesting is that during a time when girls' sports had really been all but eliminated in interscholastic sports, girls of color throughout the country, we know this from Susan Kahn's history of U.S. sports and girls and women in U.S. sports, and at Salinas High School, since the largest group, I think around 14% of the pre-war student population were Japanese American kids, they were very active in sports, and girls especially were involved in, Japanese girls were involved in basketball and baseball and other sports. So,
can I ask you a quick question on that?
Yes.
I just think listeners would find this interesting because I think, you know, like my son's high school, for example, you know, there are teams that are, even though it's a very multiracial high school, there are teams that are, you know, monochromatic in terms of people's backgrounds. Were there particular sports that Japanese girls in particular would gravitate towards while other sports were more white dominated, or was there a very healthy mix?
Japanese girls and boys especially gravitated to basketball. And there's a long history of that. One of my former students, Nicole Willems, wrote a great book on this a number of years ago called When Girls Ruled the Court. And it's on the development of Japanese American basketball along the West Coast, not just California, but Oregon, Washington. Japanese American community basketball associations for girls and women, boys and men. So when Title IX rolled around, Japanese American girls had a leg up on a lot of other girls in having played a lot of competitive basketball. Now, recently, you mentioned your kids having maybe some teams that have more monochromatic racial orders. One of the things I found really interesting in the Salinas High School yearbook is as we move into the late 20th and early 21st century, Salinas becomes a predominantly Hispanic, if you want to use the sort of term from the census, Latinx, and I think now it's less than 20% white at Salinas High School, or all white, and so what the sports that get introduced in the late 20th century and early 21st century that are interesting in this respect. The sport that's interesting most to me is soccer, because a lot of Mexican American kids were already very good at soccer, knew soccer very well. And there's a really kind of interesting race gender difference here that develops in that from the very first, when they start offering boys soccer at Salinas High School, it is almost predominantly Latino boys playing it. There's a few white boys that play it in some years, but the coaches and the boys, almost all Latino. Girls soccer, though, really better reflects the demographics of the school. Lots of Latinas, but some Asian girls, some white girls. There are not too many black kids at Salinas High School, but a few. And I think there's a really interesting kind of different history, sort of gendered history and racialized history of soccer that might help to explain that. That the fact that the boys soccer is so, as you said, monochromatic, and the girls soccer is really reflects more the racial demographics of the school. You know, another sport that's super interesting to me just recently in the last 10 to 15 years is the introduction of girls wrestling. And at Salinas High School, it's mixed, but it seems that the wrestling stars are mostly Latinas. And they're really reveling in, I think, at least the way it comes through in the yearbooks, in the sort of empowerment of being wrestlers and being girl wrestlers, and really kind of pushing back against some of the kind of myths of female frailty that might be especially strong in some communities.
Wow. I also find it's so interesting, this period that we associate with the women's liberation movement. And what that does to women's sports, to Title IX, to almost even the looks on the faces of the players themselves, which I found interesting. What did you draw from that particularly tumultuous period in the history of women's sports?
Well, it's an exciting time to be looking at yearbooks during, you know, the sort of pre and immediately post Title IX era. I mean, sports teams don't really start expanding much until 3 or 4 years after Title IX, but you start to see team sports developing. But one of the stories that I tell, kind of pre-Title IX stories that I tell that I really like, is a picture in the 1968 yearbook of these four girls running really hard on the track, looking very determined, and they're training for something. It was called the Turkey Trot. It was a community based kind of mini marathon, I think.
We do that here.
and that picture just seemed anomalous to me, because all of the other photos. The 50s were bad for girls in sports. The 60s were even worse in terms of just the ways in which they were either ignored in the yearbooks, or if they were focused on, it was very insulting sorts of captions, and that emphasized girls' apparent, you know, incompetence in sports. And you could only get the sense that girls just weren't capable and shouldn't be playing sports at all if you looked at the yearbooks. But this shot really stood out, because you could see these girls were running hard and training hard. They looked very athletic. And only because I spoke with somebody who was in that picture did I learn that these girls were really determined to have a track team in 1968, when there was no track team for girls, no interscholastic competition for girls. And the only thing they could train for was this community-based turkey trot. So they trained very hard. They went and competed in it, and one of them took second place, and then she wasn't recognized as a second place winner because she wasn't a male. And I used that as a way to talk about how about girls and women's agency pre-Title IX, that there were girls in the 50s and 60s who were playing sports. They were determined. They liked playing sports, and they were kind of pushing up against the barriers that had been set up for them. And a lot of girls of that generation, I think, figure like 4 years, 6 years later, they're in college or just out of that sort of age. A lot of them were the young women who fueled the feminist movement. And it was out of, having to face those kinds of constraints. The other thing that I think is interesting about women's movements is, a broader sort of theme of the book that I really try to emphasize, is that how this, looking at this long scope, 1903 to 2024, really helps us understand what I call the unevenness of social change, that progress doesn't really move in some sort of linear forward manner. It kind of goes backwards and sideways and forwards. And in the early 20th century, the teens, the early 20s, girls' sports are booming in high schools and I think to a certain extent in colleges too. At Salinas High School, you have girls' interscholastic basketball, track and field, baseball, not softball, baseball, and some other competitive sports. The girls are appearing in the yearbooks in Salinas High School uniforms. They are treated very respectfully. Their competitions with other schools are reported very respectfully. And why does that happen in the early 20th century? Because you have a really strong, vibrant women's movement that's pushing for the empowerment of women. It's pushing for not just the vote, but for the rights to control your body, the rights to physical empowerment, the rights to have a job and control your paycheck. And so there's a sort of wave of athletic feminism that's happening during that time. And then there's a big backlash against it it starts, you can feel it kind of bubbling in the yearbooks in the mid-20s. And then by the 30s, interscholastic girls' sports is pretty much gone for almost 50 years in public schools, not just Salinas High, but all over. And it's incorporated under the aegis of the GAA, the Girls Athletic Association, which is all about non-competitive sports, physical activity for girls that's considered appropriate, not a lot of running, jumping, and so adapted rules. Basketball is developed so that girls can play basketball without having to run very much. In fact, the rules mitigated against them running. You can only bounce the ball twice, stay in a certain part of the court. And then in your original question about Title IX and that period in the late 60s, early 70s, that's a time when we also have a really vibrant and powerful women's movement that's pushing for a broader role and more equity for women in public life. And that's reflected in this sort of expansion of girls and women's sports around the world. And Title IX gets a lot of credit in the US, but I've talked with colleagues, who are sports studies colleagues from Europe and Canada, and they say, Title IX, US people always talking about Title IX, but it was really important for you. But we had the same boom in girls and women's sports in our countries, and Title IX really only covers your country. So I think it's important to think about Title IX as a really important legal tool, but it's really the women's movement and it's really feminism that led to that real expansion of girls and women's sports. And the last thing, just about uneven social change, we're living in a moment now where we can see the real efforts at backlash in across the whole spectrum, not just in sports. And any sort of sense anyone might have of sort of linear progress having succeeded from the movements of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, I think we're learning that all of those things are under threat now.
No, that's a very important point. And I'll say, speaking of that, what about differences in the 21st century? The most recent historical turn. And I ask you that in part because I think people like myself, I won't put you in that category, but people in your line of work, we tend to have things pretty set until the year 2000. And I think the last 25 years have been very difficult for a lot of us to understand. I mean, to have, for example, the 2010s be the decade of protest internationally, and yet now we find ourselves in the grips internationally of a far-right authoritarianism, and the buds for all of this in the Iraq War, the bailout under Obama. I mean, there's so much we can point to that's made these last 25 years particularly dyspeptic. Do you see anything in the yearbooks in the 21st century that lends itself to either an understanding or an amplification of what we've seen over the last quarter century?
Well, that's a really great question. Yearbooks, I think I started out by saying they're a great window into understanding certain things, but they're also a very limited window because, and I met with the yearbooks class a year ago when I was visiting the school, and I was talking to them about how yearbooks are kind of like any window, they're a frame, and they sort of show certain things and block out other things that are outside the frame. And in many of the yearbooks, up until probably around the 1990s, there was very, very little that shows up that's really outside the frame of what happens inside the school. And in the 90s, you start to see, in part because Salinas in the 80s and 90s was a town where poverty was really growing, and there was a lot of anxiety about gang violence and shifting demographics. You start to see the walls between the school and the community starting to get a little bit more fuzzy. And students who are on your book and their advisors start to think about what are the things that are going on outside the school that are impacting us here. So there's a lot of focus on drug use. There's a lot of there's students who are organizing anti-violence groups, anti-gender-based violence groups as well as just generally anti-violence groups. You see student you see little features on students who are politically active in supporting immigrant rights. During the Black Lives Matter moment, you see a couple of photographs of students out protesting for Black Lives Matter. So you start to see a little bit of the outside world permeating the school's discourse, I guess you'd say, in the yearbooks. One thing that I found really interesting that's very, very recent, and it doesn't really speak so much to the broader kind of politics that your question is based on. But one of the things that just happened in the last 2 years, nationally and at Salinas High, is girls starting to play flag football, and they love it. They've just poured into flag football, and for decades, probably starting in the 1960s, there was something called powder puff football that would be like maybe one or two games that would be intramural, and sometimes there's a big gender inversion ritual around that where the boy football players would dress as cheerleaders, sometimes smearing their faces with lipstick and putting on really fake oversized breasts to sort of exaggerate femininity. But the girls took those games very seriously. But now they actually have interscholastic flag football. And it's extremely popular just like that at the get-go. And one of the questions that's come up about that is a question that's similar to a lot of the others that have been raised about adapted sports for girls. Girls love to play football. Why do they play flag football instead of tackle football like the boys? And one answer to that is that it reflects kind of old, outmoded protective legislation that kept girls and women out of certain public activities they were considered incapable of or too vulnerable to do. But I ask a different question that is that now that we know what football does to bodies, and now that we know especially what playing football and repeated bumps to the head does to the brain, why do we tolerate and even celebrate football for boys? So I raised that question, and I use that as a way to kind of look at the historical role of football as it's developed in high schools, and not just that we, I think, haven't looked that critically at issues related to boys and health nearly to the extent that we have with girls and health, but also the incredible investment in football. It's financial investment, but it's also emotional investment. And football, going back to the 1920s, really has become was then and still is the centerpiece of the kind of ritual complex of high schools in developing and celebrating group identity and collective identity. And there's so much collective emotion invested in that it makes it very, very difficult for people to seriously address questions related to health and head injuries for boys. And early in the 20th century, you probably know this day, but there was a moment in the teens when football was eliminated in a lot of colleges and high schools, and this shows up in the Salinas High yearbook. You have football a few years, it goes away. There's discussion about it in the yearbook. It's replaced with rugby for 3 or 4 years, and they say they're doing that because it was done that way at Stanford and Cal, and so it must be a better game. But we also know that there were deaths, there were football deaths, there was a lot of violence around football. There's kind of corruption in college football during that period of time. And then it resumes after World War I, and a lot of that has to do, I think, with fears of feminization of men that bubbled up or during the war, the sense that American young men weren't masculine enough, that the recruits weren't physically tough enough. And football comes in, and there's this moment of militarization of sports and physical education in the immediate aftermath of World War I. And that's when football really starts booming in high schools and at Salinas High School. And you can see the celebratory pageantry that starts to develop around it. And by the time you get into the middle of the 20th century, it's just really big.
Well, but let me ask you this. I think we can have a discussion about the role of football culture in the American high school. Has it been a net positive or net negative over the last 100 years in terms of how it's shaped modes and of manhood and intergender relations, power relationships in schools? There's so many injuries, as you mentioned. There's so many things to really pick at and analyze, but let's really drill it down to just Salinas. Has football been positive for Salinas High School broadly over the last century?
That's a tough question to answer simply. I think if you asked people there at the high school, they would just unequivocally say yes. I mean, they love it, and you know, again, going back to the investments in it, you know, even during times of financial difficulties and with funding schools in recent decades, when they needed to raise money for a new artificial turf field, they went to the big agribusiness people and got money to put in a new field. When they needed new lights, the Rotary Club pitched in, and school organizations pitched in. People love it, and I think it's largely due to that sort of sense that, you know, it's the Salinas Cowboys is the name of the team, that kind of cowboy pride, or purple and gold are the colors of the school, purple pride. That, you know, boys basketball is important, but football is the centerpiece of that sort of identity. It's really, you know, probably viewed as a positive by most of the kids who've played it as well. I mean, I did interviews with years ago with former athletes, and you know, after sitting and listening to a long chronicle of the injuries and surgeries and rehabs that so many of these college and professional athletes went through for their whole lives, I would ask them, "Would you do it again if you had to, if you could?" And they'd always say, "Yeah, I would do it again, even though I'm arthritic at age 45 and can't stand up straight." You know. Then again, though, if you ask people, "Would you have your kids play?" That's a little bit more of an equivocal answer. And I think some of the polls now are telling us that a lot of parents don't want their kids to play, their sons to play tackle football. And when you break that down by kind of class and race, it's mostly middle class and white parents who are much more reluctant to allow their boys to play tackle football, which, you know, it leads me to think about, you know, some of the things that I learned so long ago, and many of us learned so long ago from Harry Edwards, you know, and his discussions of, you know, who plays the most dangerous sports, and who pays the cost and the price for our entertainment in these, you know, high risk sports. And it tends to be disproportionately boys from working class backgrounds, boys of color, and so I think, you know, that's probably the direction that we're heading in the short run, I think, is that fewer white and middle class boys are going to play football, and they're moving into other kinds of sports that honestly, if you're thinking about college scholarships, there are other sports both boys and girls play that you have a much higher proportion chance to get a scholarship with.
Amen to that. That is true. Dealing with some of those issues in our house right now. Michael Messner, you've been so generous with your time, and this book is so endlessly interesting. We could talk about this another hour. I'd be so remiss, especially because we're an audio podcast, if I didn't say that the book looks absolutely gorgeous. I mean, you have to see it. It's like a yearbook. It's not like a hardcover book. It's certainly not like a textbook. It looks like a darn yearbook. And when you open it up, it even has that kind of layout. in some pages of the yearbook, in a lot of pages of a yearbook. And so I guess I just got to ask you, like, I mean, this is terrific. Like, how were you able to, I mean, we both know the publishing industry these days. How did you get them to invest in such a beautiful looking product that fits what's between the binding?
Oh, thanks, Dave, for saying that. That was my dream to have the book look like that. And it has 270 photos in it, reproduced from the old and recent yearbooks. And Rutgers University Press, you know, press that I've worked with before on other books, they, my editor, Peter Mikulis, has a sport book series there. And he went to bat for me, and the folks at Rutgers Press agreed that this was a good idea to invest in a book that looked like a yearbook and has really good paper in it and has that sort of cover design that really resembles a 1940s era high school yearbook. So I'm so grateful and pleased that they did such a nice job laying it out. They have some real pros there in their production. As you know, university presses don't have a lot of resources, and they have good people working for them, but they all pitch in and do a really good job at it.
Yeah, I mean, and some of that, of course, is the state of the publishing industry. Like, if you are working at a university press, all my experiences have been so positive.
Yeah.
To the people who put the blood, sweat, and tears into it. I'd be remiss, Michael, if I didn't ask you what music you listen to. Do you have a playlist for the high school sports spirit and citizens 1903-2024? Do you have, what was the playlist for you in writing this? I mean, such a broad expanse of decades. I mean, how do you use music to inspire you with such a breadth of topics and years? Please tell us.
I grew up a Beatles fan, and I am still a Beatles fan. You know, I listen to on the radio, I listen to the Beatles, and when I get just a little bit tired of that, I slip over to Tom Petty channel and listen to Tom Petty. So I'm kind of stuck in the classic rock era. But for me, having been, you know, a 12-year-old in 1964, when the Beatles were, you know, their movies were coming out, nothing has ever been better. And it's hard for me to believe anything ever could be better for me.
Well, as someone with USC connections, I got to ask you something then movie related. Quentin Tarantino wrote that you're either a Beatles person or a Rolling Stones person. He wrote, you can like them both, but you're either a Beatles person or a Rolling Stone person. First of all, is he full of crap? He certainly is on other things. And second of all, is are you a Beatles person?
I am a Beatles person, but I think the Rolling Stones are great. And I think it's a little bit of a false dichotomy, but there was a time, you know, in the mid 60s where there were some people who had that sort of Beatles versus Stones kind of argument going. Most of the people I hung out with were Beatles people, but all of us appreciated the Rolling Stones too.
Yeah, I think Quentin's just going for a little of that spicy dialogue that he thinks he's so famous for. Michael Messner, thank you so much for joining us here on the Edge of Sports podcast. I just want to say the name of it again. The book is called The High School, Sports, Spirit, and Citizens, 1903-2024. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Dave.
All right, we'll be back right after this, after a quick word from the sponsor of this podcast, The Nation Magazine. We'll be back right after this with a quick word from Edge of Sports. Hey, everybody out there. This is Dave Zirin with the Edge of Sports podcast. People got to know that we put this podcast on with elbow grease and bubble gum on a weekly basis. And we're proud of the work that we do. We love it. But we can't do it without support from you, the listener. So please go to patreon.com/edgeofsportspod and support the podcast. That's patreon.com/edgeofsportspod. Any little bit you might give to support the podcast actually makes a huge difference to the work we're trying to do. That's patreon.com/edgeofsportspod. We appreciate you. Make no mistake about it. And now, back to the Edge of Sports podcast. We are back on the Edge of Sports podcast, brought to you by The Nation Magazine. Now, as promised, We talked to the basketball savant, Arya Shirazi, on our March Madness. Our March Madness. March Madness back in the day when it was much more mad. You know, Shiraz, let me just start with this. You know, there's a cliche, of course, where whether somebody is 5, 15, 50, or 500, they're going to say, well, maybe not 500 for technical reasons, but they're going to say, music was better when I was a kid. You hear that all the time. Movies were better when I was a kid. You hear it all the time. And even if one thinks they are correct about this, you know someone from another generation is going to make the same statement. But here is something that people our age have, and it is platinum plated, and nobody can say jack poo. March Madness was better when we were coming up. Fact. All I want to do, Shiraz, is read to you how much, what the spread of the final score in NCAA finals games between 1982 and 1989. Here we go. 1 point, 2 points, 9 points, but it was Ewing versus Akeem, so incredibly special. 2 points, 3 points, 1 point, 4 points, 1 point. Think about that. 1, 2, 9, but special. 2, 3, 1, 4, 1. That's what we grew up on. And what's so incredible about that is that all of these games are still indelible to me. You name the year, I'll tell you something about it. Now, before we start, Shiraz, just for my own fun, any of those dates, and just hearing the spread of the games, did anything I say in the year, like, sort of connect with you to be like, oh, I remember that. That was so great, or that was so heartbreaking. I'll never forget it. Just by hearing the date and the point spread.
Those would be two of the indicators. I mean, even more, I agree with you just on the overall sentiment, which is the national championship games and the wider NCAA tournaments of those years are indelible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and have instant association, a year more than a point spread. Even all these years later, have an instant association to something kind of, you know, special and something that I loved. As I was listening to your intro, I chuckled at us a little bit, just thinking, how many people like willingly look forward to a podcast that starts with two old guys saying shit was better back in our day?
So many people. It's actually the basis of all podcasts.
Which is right. Which is exactly what we are talking about. But I agree with you. I mean, to name two other things, professional boxing and rap, I believe, was never better than when we were growing up learning it. And I put college basketball into that exact same category for a variety of reasons that I can pinpoint, and probably for a lot of reasons that I'm not hip to.
Well, yeah, I want to talk to you about that, definitely. But just a quick thing is, I think boxing, for example, was never better than when we were growing up. Never better. But if somebody said to me, like, hey, if you were around when Sugar Ray Robinson was fighting LaMotta and Carmen Basilio and those guys, like, you wouldn't be saying that. And it's kind of like, okay, well, you have a case, I have a case. I'll say Marvelous Marvin and Tommy Hearns. I'll say the Lone Star Cobra, Donald Curry. I mean, we can go back and forth about this. But I don't think anybody can go back and forth with us about 1982 to 1989, these incredible, incredible finals. They're so incredible that when they do those little NCAA history video montages, It's like, wow, did all the games occur in the 1980s? Because that seems to be the majority of the clips you're showing, in part because those players are still so recognizable decades later. So, oh, go ahead, please.
No, I was just going to say, I think you're absolutely right. I think my boxing analogy was a little bit half-baked. If somebody were to say that we did not grow up in the golden age of heavyweights, they'd be correct.
Yeah.
So that is not as much of a truism as March Madness. Yeah, and even and I have very fond memories of tournaments and championship games, kind of going fairly deep into the 90s, even until really I just didn't have the time to devote to college basketball and to educate myself enough to make the tournament as familiar as it had always been. But no, but I think you're right. And when you kind of read out the point differentials of those national championships, yeah, the 80s was just it was it. And it was and it was a treat to be watching it in real time.
Yeah, I'm gonna just run through this really quick, and then I think we want to do a bit more of a deep dive as to why it was so much better. Like, I can just do like a half sentence for each thing. 1982, freshman Jordan with the game winner. Fred Brown throws it away to James Worthy. Fred Brown in tears. John Thompson hugging him. Dean Smith finally wins a championship. Boom! Amazing. 1983, Jim Valvano running around the court after Lorenzo Charles with the dunk at the buzzer. Boom. 84, Ewing versus Hakeem speaks for itself. 9 points, a bit of an outlier, outlier in those times. Boom. 1985, Villanova, Raleigh Massimino. Holy crap. Ed Pinckney besting Ewing, winning by 2 points. Greatest upset in history. Boom. 86, never nervous Purvis Ellison. With the foul shots, back when being a freshman and being able to knock down free throws actually meant something because he wasn't going to the league the next year. Boom. 1987. Oh my goodness, you know what this is? the one that I love and you abhor, and that would be Keith Smart with the shot. Oh, beating us, an awesome Syracuse team. We can talk about that more. Boom, El General, Bobby Knight becomes a legend with that win. So unearned. 1988, Danny and the Miracles, another huge upset over a stacked Oklahoma team. Boom. And then 1989, overtime, Glenn Rice, Ramil Robinson with the clutch free throws, Michigan, and the incredible, like, mythos around that game, the way their coach Bill Frieder announced he was leaving after the tournament, and he got fired by athletic director Bo Schembechler, who said, "If we're going to the tourney, we're going to be coached by a Michigan man." And then Steve Fisher, va-voom, takes them all the way. So much mythos in what I just said, and I spoke for just like 2 minutes. So, Shiraz, feel free, if you want to comment on any of the games, but also, man, like, why do you, what are the factors that made it so much better? Because it's a lot more than just them being, like close games.
Well, I think, and again, even as you were giving kind of the quick highlights of each year, it's like, yeah, each one just absolutely fantastic, important to a young sports fan, a basketball fan, a kind of an incredible decade long string of indelible games and players and coaches and all of that stuff. I think one reason why it was so great at that time was because college basketball had hit. I think Magic versus Bird in 1979 didn't only have huge positive reverberations for the NBA. both of those guys entering the NBA right after that game and becoming the signature players of that decade. But that final and those two players captured the national imagination, I think, in a way that that college basketball never had before. And obviously, there had been national champions for years, but I think the idea of the NCAA tournament then became something that network television decided was a boom. I don't think in 1978 it was called March Madness. I don't think in 79 it was March Madness. It was, I think, what that matchup and that star power did was add another huge money-making element to the sports landscape that I don't think anybody had been able to extract out of college basketball. College football, yes. But not hoops. So I think the reason that those tournaments and those finals, aside from the incredible competition, are so well remembered is that for the first time it was treated like a big deal. I actually don't remember exactly the year, but it's in the early part of the 80s, I believe, that the tournament expands to 64 teams.
Yeah, I'll look that up. I believe that was in 84.
84,
About
even,
second.
right. So, I mean, we are seeing this made for TV format where that then leads into those crazy first 2 days, and people filling out brackets.
I was off by one. 85 was the first round 64. Before that, it was 32.
So I think the time that we're talking about and the specialness of that time is because this tournament was evolving and becoming what it became, setting the standard that now opens itself up to disappointment.
I want to like also clear the decks of what I'm sure people are thinking is the obvious point. Because even if it's true, it's obvious and too obvious. I mean, one of the reasons we loved these games so much was because we really did know the players. Because even Hakeem stayed 3 years at Houston. And by the way, made the Final Four all 3 years. And even, Ewing, of course, stayed four. I mean, Manning stayed four and could have eased Danny Manning could have easily have gone out after his freshman year. So when you followed somebody like, say, Danny Manning for all 4 years and you see the greatness, he's breaking all the records in his conference. And back then, I know it sounds old, but we knew who the teams were in each conference. Wasn't this weird musical chairs? Well, you're football here and basketball here. And hey, West Coast team, you're now in the ACC. None of that crap. But what you did have,
You think it's weird that Stanford would be in the Big East? What's strange about that, Dave? Geography?
I guess it is east of Mongolia. That has to count for something. Oops, ignore that. But I'll tell you the thing that, that resonates though is the fact that because people stayed longer, you followed their whole careers. Danny Manning, I'll never forget this, like his senior year at Kansas, being really bummed out for him at the start of the tournament because his team kind of sucked, and he'd had three incredibly successful years in terms of win losses. Freshman year, they went to the Final Four, and now he's ending with a team that has double digit losses, and then man, they just jumped on his back and he rode his way through. And before beating an Oklahoma team that had three first round draft picks, right? Stacey King, Harvey Grant, and Mookie Blaylock. What a team.
Definitely favored the Sooners for sure.
Yeah, huge favorite and favorites. And so, that's where I come down on that. Like, I don't want to overstate it or overtalk it, but the fact that we followed players through their college career, saw them develop, we're even like we were all even like amateur scouts, like how will this person play in the NBA? I remember it being, ooh, I really hope the Knicks get Mark Jackson in the draft. Will he still be there at 18? Like, I remember all that stuff. So that's a huge difference. But I think there are other ones that are even more interesting for me as to why I was so much better.
I don't think you're overstating that at all. I think the fact that it wasn't just guys with a name on a jersey. As you said, we got to know those players mostly over 4 years. Danny Manning was not an anomaly being a number one pick as a senior. Most of the number one picks were seniors. Most of the great college players played 4 years. You only came out after your second year
So
if
rare.
you were a super phenom like Magic or Isaiah.
Ralph
You
Sampson.
flunked out of school, or you were so poor that you had to start getting paid. As you said, special players like Olajuwon and Jordan came out after 3 years. And many of the best players like Ewing and Manning and a ton others stayed four. So, yes, that is a reason there was this familiarity, and not just familiarity, but players, you looked at them almost like you did the pros. If you felt if you loved your college basketball team more than your NBA team, then the college players were your favorite players. You had talked about my personal heartbreak at Syracuse losing by one in 87. That's not just because guys were wearing orange. It was Cyke Lee and Derek Coleman, who was a freshman at the time, and Sherman Douglas, and because of that loss, I was aware of their careers for their I was aware of time running out, and they never got back there. So it wasn't just the school. It was identifying a college with certain players, and if they came up short, knowing who was coming back and who wasn't. Because they graduated, and we were, and it caused us to be aware of the top high school players, who was possibly coming in, who could be a difference maker. Is there a freshman that could put your team over the top, or could possibly do his part in replacing this beloved departed senior? Stuff like that. That's a totally different world now that I'm describing, but I think the companion to that, which is one of the two big obvious things that I can identify as to why the landscape and I think the romance of college basketball and March Madness has largely vanished, is the alteration of the professional scouting projections. The time we're talking about, it was not looked at as a detriment or a failing if you stayed 4 years, came out at 22 years old, 21 years old, because the teams wanted you to be as close to a finished product as you could be, or really for them to know what kind of player they were adding. Not coincidentally, right around, I think, the turn of the 90s is when teams started to look at potential more prized than college production, and we're looking for 20-year-old franchise players rather than 22-year-old franchise players, started to pick those sophomores earlier in the lottery than they had. It used to be it came out after 2, 3 years, even, or certainly 2. And most of the time, eyebrows were raised. You were doing your career kind of a disservice a little bit. Stay and get better, and you'll be picked higher and make more money. Now, you know, that got totally inverted. So, as the top picks started being sophomores and then freshmen, that is naturally going to alter the college game at the top level because the top players, you're not getting to know them under a 3, 4 year period. If they're getting any positive feedback from the NBA, you're probably going to see them for 1 year.
That's very helpful. You know, I think there's another thing too that I think made these 80s things so entertaining. And that is something that I think we've largely lost, which for reasons that are mind-boggling to me, it just shows you the power of nostalgia. I found myself last weekend not altogether upset that my St. John Johnnies, my Johnnies, lost to Arkansas and their head coach John Calipari. Calipari is quite the scuzz. And yet I was happy that he advanced in the tournament. I was happy that him and Patino were even going against each other. I mean, if I call Calipari a scuzz, I mean that makes Rick Pitino like looking up from the gutter at Calipari, like ugh. Like Pitino's had his certainly had his public moments. I take back what I said about Coach Cal. He's more of a sleaze. But here's what Calipari is, and here's what Pitino is. They are big personalities on the sideline. You don't really have big personalities on the sideline in the NBA anymore. I mean, most NBA coaches now, they look like divorced dads. You know, like they were once in shape, now they're a little doughy. They're all wearing those like skin tight Under Armour tops. You know, I'll tell you, man, you know I'm no conservative, but my most conservative view is probably that I want an executive order that coaches have to wear coats and ties again. If it was good enough for Doug Moe, God damn it should be good enough for, I don't know, Tyronn Lue, who just looks like a divorced dad. Like he's waiting for pickup for a kid who's surly, you
The
know?
NBA sideline has gone full Bob Huggins now.
Oh, so much Huggins. So much Huggy Huggins. But Huggins is another one. Like a reprobate of the first order. But so great to see him on the sideline, like stalking around. Like even if you hated these guys, I mean, and I'm gonna name people I loved, but in these years that I just reeled off at the start of the show. I mean, you know, like Valvano, Massimino, John Thompson, Dean Smith, Denny Crum, Young Krzyzewski, Jim Boeheim, and of course, El General, Bobby Knight. And I didn't even mention PJ Carlesimo. I mean, and Larry Brown, too, of Kansas. I mean, big personalities. And it made you want to tune in. Because you felt like they were doing something extra wise just because they were wearing a repulsive sports coat.
No, you identified, I think, a crucial ingredient of the huge success and appeal of biggest time college basketball at that time, because you are absolutely right. I might have, followed Derek Coleman over a 4-year span, but when he leaves, it was still Boeheim on the sideline. So you're right. The very, very top programs and the programs that were going to be competing annually for the national championship and largely getting the blue chippiest recruits who were ultimately going to be top NBA picks. No, it was the cult of the coach. The coach was who You were really not a big time school unless you were identified with your coach. So that was a huge, you named the biggies, and if we wanted to bore your audience, we could probably name 20 more. So right, and that was, and it was a, and they stayed, and they all had their kind of different flavor, and that really exactly, that was the constancy. That was the right. The players came and went. And you would become attached to players, and it was sad if a player graduated and left. But right, I mean, it was what is this coach, which is so indelibly associated with that school, what is that coach going to do with the team this year, and who is going to emerge as a new star for this coach? So that is a huge, was as big a factor as any that I agree with you has really doesn't exist much anymore in the NBA. Really doesn't exist in the NBA, as you said, and is pretty much a relic in college. Even Jay Wright leaving Villanova. And he certainly, did not have the outsized persona as the earlier generation, but even he is like, oh, that's another institution gone now.
Yeah,
So,
and I think today, I mean, we're talking about Tom Izzo at Michigan State,
for sure.
and I but no, but I struggle after that in terms of thinking of who are like the real OGs, post Coach K is that I mean Izzo I think is really like the last of the dying breed, but it is fun to look back and think about like. Why were the coaches even an attraction? Like they weren't they all engaging in histrionics like Raleigh Massimino, but they had personality. Like, do you remember Lou Carnesecca's disgusting sweater that he wore once, but then with the Chris Mullin, Walter Berry team, but then they go on a win streak. So Carnesecca decides he's never gonna take off the sweater, and they're playing Georgetown in a big game. And Big John Thompson goes up to shake hands with Louie, and he opens up his jacket. Remember how huge a guy Thompson was, and he compared to little Louie. And he's Thompson is wearing a replica of Louie's sweater, like five times the size. I know, I know. Now I'm definitely doing the do you remember when? But these guys had like a sense of personality and showmanship and flair that back then even like the NBA coaches did not have in the same way. And so I shouldn't even just be like NBA coaches now, because back then, you had your Doug Moe's here and there, but really you're talking about college where the personalities really just crack the screen.
And it was also so much more regional,
Yeah,
the
great
way it
point.
should be. So the Big East was whatever it was, nine teams that were all like literally in four East Coast states. You didn't have to get on a plane to play interconference games. And these guys were going at each other two or three times every single year, which helped build up appealing animosity, but also, as you said, developed a relationship between these coaches who were competing against each other every year on the court and for recruits. And so, we're able to, again, I go back to continuity because that's really what it was. You were mentioning kind of that one thing between Thompson and Carnesecca. If it was like the second time those guys had met, who'd care? But it's because of the history and knowing that Carnesecca's team was always chasing Thompson's team, as almost everyone in the Big East usually was. And so when he got one over on John, when
Huge.
St. John's could beat Georgetown, it was a very big deal. So that all I think just played into The stakes were higher because we see, like, we were kind of allowed to be part of the story.
Yeah, that's a good point. I like that a lot. And the rise of the Big East also gave rise to more space for these big personalities. I don't think they weren't all in the Big East, of course, and the ones we named weren't all in the Big East. The ACC certainly had its share, but there was something about the Big East, coming to these small, private, largely Catholic colleges, that didn't, a lot of them didn't even have football. And so it was like basketball was king at these schools, men's basketball. And so you had this amplification, like they were all like Little Caesars, not the pizza. I'm thinking more Edward G. Robinson, but they were all Little Caesars. And that sort of ego that they all had, like also cracked the screen and made for compelling television. But you named something else that I want to put a finger on, and that's, you mentioned about how when St. John's finally beat Hoya Paranoia, which was a huge game, Mullen leading them to victory, won by 2 points. I remember it as if it was yesterday. That wasn't a tournament game. That wasn't even a Big East tournament game. Like, I remember just being clued in to college basketball in October, November, December. Like, you wanted to see these guys. Not just because you were an NBA fan, but because you wanted to see these rivalries, and the rivalries meant something. And that is something, young fans really just aren't going to experience in the same way. I mean, you may still have the Duke North Carolinas, but there used to be rivalries all over the place that had real weight and that made for very compelling television.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the when thinking or talking about college basketball, it's this paradox. I was going to say unique paradox, but maybe it's not that unique. But as things have gotten more just for the athlete and for the student, I think the game has gotten worse for the fan. The time that we're looking back so reminiscing so warmly about, with those the cult of coach personalities that were really played the starring roles in those dramas, the NCAA is a horrible organization. You have been, speaking of that and kind of citing examples for years now, educating me on that over the years.
It's made a big difference.
And what's that?
It's made a big difference.
And these coaches that we're talking about, I mean, it was an un, you know, the NCAA was this incredibly exploitative entity, and the coaches were totally benefiting off that. These coaches who had branded themselves as this school had huge six-figure or high six-figure sneaker deals, apparel deals, while their players, weren't allowed to get on-campus employment. So there was this big disparity, and it was always how to improve that without kind of, top recruits going to the highest bidder. That never seemed the answer to me. Having money floating around openly in high school gyms and knowing that Duke and UCLA and Kentucky can pay out the most, that wasn't appealing to me, even once I knew that this system had to be completely overhauled. So now you have the NIL, which I'm actually not super educated on, Dave. I actually don't really know how it works.
Just think the Wild West.
Yeah, but
all you have to say.
the whole
It's the
thing, like
Wild
the
West.
little I know about it is just kind of a little bit unseemly to me because it's and I think, in addition to it hurting the mid-majors and small D1 schools even more, because as if you didn't know it already, the big schools, they have all the money. And if players are looking at who's offering them the most, it's going to be the usual suspects.
Or offering them anything like the mid majors. I mean, these are schools that operate at a loss. They don't have extra money lying around, particularly because they don't have big boosters the way a school like Michigan will. And so, like this year, for example, people are really surprised that Alabama is making a serious NCAA tournament run. It's like, yeah, they're making a tournament run because they go to a big money football school and can now siphon off the football money to stack the team. So it's a totally different dynamic at a school like Alabama that can now effectively buy players. And I have no problem with, you know this, like no problem with players making money. The whole system makes billions. Let them get their share. But the unregulated aspect of it really bothers me. Because I don't like the idea of, big old Texas ho-ho-ho being like, I do declare, here's a check for $5 million if you leave the University of Michigan and come to our good school at SMU. That's legal. Nothing wrong with that in NIL. And that's what bothers me. I'd like to see it regulated in a fashion that just allows for more fairness in the process. And also, isn't this weird system where, like, a quarterback could be offered $3 million to transfer schools, and his offensive lineman at the new school could be have nothing. No room and board, but not making a cent. And, like, that's the unseemly part for me, like, blocking for somebody who's a millionaire when you don't have jack shit. I mean,
Seems
how
to
does
be
that not?
counterintuitive to team building
It
and locker
is.
room trust and chemistry.
It is. When you get there on your bus pass and your quarterback rolls up in a Lamborghini, it's not a great feel for team unity, I don't think.
Yeah, as I said, I am very uneducated about how it really all works or doesn't work. The little I know about it is all a little bit gross to me. But it's really only watching some of the tournament the last week or so that I realize the extent how pervasive the transfer window is. One rule I always used to like was that if you transferred, you had to sit out a year. It was a huge drag for the athlete. But there was a little bit of justice to that. You couldn't just jump to jump. It made your choice of college, it made that serious. Because if you thought you'd made a mistake for whatever reason, you had to decide, is it worth it? Is it worth it to leave? Because you have to sit out and in your off year be a student in good standing and be eligible to then be able to play. It really made I don't know, it just kind of made sense. Now I'm hearing a player and it's like, oh, he's on his third team in 4 years. And ultimately good for them. Do what right. It is the new landscape. It's not the day of Oscar Robertson anymore. And my day was not the day of Oscar Robertson.
You better be clear about that.
But I think that even further erodes the idea of continuity and the idea of, I mean, now it isn't just chasing a pro opportunity as soon as you can. It's, I mean, who's offering money? Who's offering the most money? Is anybody offering any money? I'm gonna jump here. Now that time, I'm gonna jump here and jump here. And that at least is not what college sports was when I was learning about college sports. And just as a fan, and a fan from an ever distancing vantage point, certainly than I used to be with college basketball, I tune in this time of year and learn a few players. Now that's kind of what I have time for, room for. And I still love watching the 3 weeks of the tournament. But I think that that is one of the final nails in the death of college basketball as we knew it in the decade of the 80s, and I'd say the 90s as well.
Let me bring this to my favorite topic, which is capitalism. Because and herein lies the contradiction of why it kind of sucks right now. Because it is profound, it is just immoral to have like this constitutional cutout where college athletes are basically are don't I mean now we have a president administration that doesn't give a shit about the Constitution, but a cutout where these athletes basically have no constitutional rights. That's the way it was as recently as a few years ago. No rights to their name, image, and likeness, no rights to even have a bagel with cream cheese. That was actually a violation in the NCAA rules. Every school had a somebody in the big schools I'm talking about would have a very well-paid, and they earned their money, well-paid person on staff who is just in charge of compliance. And making sure, because nobody knew the rules and they would change all the time. And, before you know it, you're suspended because you gave a kid a ride to a class. I mean, real little stuff. And then you had the scandal, which I think started to change things when Shabazz Napier, the great point guard for UConn, went public with him like sneaking into the cafeteria for being so hungry at night because the meals were done. So, and if Shabazz was around in NIL times, he'd have, seven figures in his, at least six figures in his pocket. And here he is like stealing slices of ham. So, this was not fair. The idea, and, I actually agree with you on the basis of the quality of the product, but the idea that like coaches could get up and move willy-nilly, but players would have to sit out for a year, not fair. But now we're seeing that when you actually say, okay, well, you want capitalism for the athletes, here's capitalism for the athletes. You get 700 people in the transfer portal for this year who are just going to be on different teams next year. You got, my son plays sports out here. He's losing two offensive linemen because high schools are paying them to transfer. I mean, this is high school. And of course, it's to private schools because they're actually, this is the unfairness too. They're allowed to do that while public schools are not. So it's a ridiculous scene. And to me, it just shows how the fun of sports, the competition of sports, and capitalism are a contradiction, just like healthcare and capitalism are a contradiction. We should have socialized healthcare. Like there are certain things that just simply do not make sense for a dog eat dog economic system, and I feel like certainly college sports is one of them.
Most things in this world that are beautiful, Dave, don't last forever. That's
Damn.
why a lot of people are still getting divorced. And
Like NBA coaches.
I don't say that I don't say that just as an empty sentence. We had talked about boxing before, and some of my favorite sports memories, some of my favorite sports figures are the boxers I grew up watching and following in the 80s and 90s. And as we had said, we knew about the rich history of boxing that had come before that. To my limited knowledge, that is dead. That is not what boxing is anymore. I honestly don't know that I can really name an active boxer unless Roy Jones Jr. is still active. But and is that worth lamenting? And if and I don't know, maybe everything's worth lamenting, maybe nothing really is. But in a way, it's like, yes, we're even the inherent contradictions that we've been talking about. College basketball in all of its unjustness, how it was able to play out like that. College basketball at that time was really beautiful and stood on its own. I was always an NBA fan, first and foremost, but I loved college basketball. I had a unique relationship with college basketball and its players and its coaches and the NCAA tournament every year. I still enjoy the tournament. I'm enjoying the games that I've watched. I'm enjoying it, for what it is now. And what it is now for people who are just learning the game, that is what it is. And everything else was history. This is what it is. And 20 years from now, they're gonna like what it is now more. But yeah, I think what I'm struggling to get at is that I think what we've identified is that, yes, I mean, the system certainly is not perfect now, far from it, with, as you said, the top 15 schools able to offer unlimited bounty and everybody else just losing their players or at risk of losing players. But that's March Madness can't be 1989 anymore. And I think that just makes it makes people like us enjoy thinking or talking about for brief periods college basketball in 1989.
Are you saying where have you gone, Rumeal Robinson? Our
Possibly.
nation turns its lonely eyes to you.
Hopefully he's on a beach in Jamaica, but could be
I hope
anywhere.
so. I don't think he cares if our lonely eyes are turning to him. Or Glenn Rice, for example, on that same Michigan team who, as a college student, had an affair with Sarah Palin when she was a young sports reporter. I just look for excuses to share that.
That should always be shared.
At all times,
Yeah. Glenn
especially.
has had, I love Glenn Rice, man.
What a player.
Always loved Glenn Rice as a college player, loved Glenn Rice as a pro. And it turns out that I think I'm a fan of his off the court as well. So.
I think that's a fair statement all around, and therefore you're a fan of Sarah Palin because of her taste
Well, I
with
mean,
Glenn
she's keeping
Rice.
an eye on Russia, you know?
Hey, someone has
So,
to, although no comment.
from a lighthouse in Alaska,
Oh
she's got
wow.
the telescope.
Yeah, she opened the door for so much. So one last thing, Shiraz, you've been amazing with your time. Yeah, we can talk about the present. I want to say something about this year's tournament that may sound very obvious, but I really feel like I got to come clean about this. Until this tournament, I did not get Cooper Flagg in terms of people saying not only is he the number one pick, because remember at the start of the year it was like, well, he'll be number one, but Dylan Harper at Rutgers, you never know. Bailey also at Rutgers, you never know. It's Flagg, but let's see how the season goes. To now people out before the tournament were saying, and I didn't watch a lot of college ball this year, were saying like, yeah, this guy isn't just the clear number one. He might be a generational talent. And I heard that and I was like, I don't get that because he's not, when you speak about gener and he names some other people that they've given that generational talent label to who've been number one picks over the last decade or so. And they said people like Wemby, of course, Anthony Davis. And I'm just like, do I really see Cooper Flagg as having that kind of physical dominance that could put him on that stage? And what does he even do well? Well, my answer now is he does everything well. B, the stereotype, which is often attributed to white players, so I rolled my eyes about this all year, that he has a motor that just doesn't stop. He actually does have a motor that just doesn't stop. He's always the most intense guy on the court. And third thing is, I'm not saying that because I'm not an idiot, I'm not saying he's an athlete like LeBron. I'm not an idiot. But when I watch him on the court, it reminds me of the high school games I saw with LeBron, where he just looked like a big brother playing with his little brothers. And that's what it looks like when I see Cooper Flagg on the court in these tournament games. Like a little bit taller, a little bit broader, a little bit faster, a little bit more exact in his movements, no look alley-oops like on consecutive possessions. I mean, I get it. And I also get why people say one of the reasons they love him so much is that he really is a guy who get in where you fit in. Like whatever your team is, he's going to figure out a way to contribute because his skill set is so broad. He's not like, say, Reed Shepherd, who it's like, oh, wow, we have a lot of guards in Houston. Therefore, this guy everybody thought was going to be rookie of the year can't play. Like Flagg can play anywhere. And I am praying that he gets to be teamed up with the great Alex Sarr for the Washington Wizards. That would be fun. This is a basketball town, baby, and we've never had a pro team worthy of it.
No, I've heard of Flag only for the past year as the presumptive number one pick. Heard kind of the same lofty adjectives that you had. Didn't see him play in the regular season at all. So I've really only seen him take the court in the last couple of games, and I haven't really sat down and watched. I've caught some of Duke the last few games, watched him more against Arizona. And yeah, he just does everything better than everybody else on the court, at least for those two teams. And he's 6'9". I think that's the thing. He moves so effortlessly in, whether he has the ball, whether he doesn't, whether he's on offense, whether he's on defense. I remember I kind of like looked up for the first time in a couple of minutes when the game was on and saw him just have this insane like chase down block. And it's like, oh, that's what he's doing, right? And so I think that's it. I think that he moves like a 6'5" all-star, but he's 6'9". So I think that's what changes the projection from future all-star to generational player. We've talked about height on many different shows in many different regards, because it's basketball. So basketball, you talk about height. And if somebody is projected to be able to do something at 6'3", and this other guy is projected to do those very same things at 6'8", the taller guy is going to be the better prospect every single time. So I still don't know Flag's game nearly enough to be able to talk about, but just in response to that, yeah, I finally saw him take the court, and in the few plays I saw, it's like, yeah, I think I get it.
Yeah, exactly.
And I hope that he goes to Washington. I
Thank
hope he goes
you.
to the Wizards.
Nicest thing you've said to me in a long time. Thank you very much.
There are, there are a few different tanking outfits in the league, but I don't think anybody is in the downtrodden category that the Bullets are. So I hope he goes to DC, man. I really do. I hope he's your player for the next 15 years.
Oh man, that would be so cool after the vicious tease of the John Wall years, where it was so fun to see him and he was so injured and his career ended way too soon. Or the Gilbert Arenas time, even shorter window than Wall, looked so great, looked so great. Or the Etan Thomas years, my radio co-host on the Collision, such a good time. And but I gotta tell you, man, the Wizards have some great young players. Cooper Flagg, I mean, this is gonna sound so stereotypical, I don't care. He makes, or cliched, I should say, he makes the people around him better. You can see it. and his teammates, this is also, like, I look for this stuff. His teammates love his ass, which is also really cool, you know, because he passes. Like, he's a really good passer. And that's the other thing. It's like you said it perfectly, that he just does everything better than everybody else. So if you need him to just do one of those things because of how your team is constructed, and maybe you're like, well, we're not going to let this 19-year-old, we're not going to build around him directly, not when we have the great Jordan Poole at point. I mean, it allows you to integrate him into any kind of a flow, and he's going to do just fine. I'm into this guy, and I'm getting a little bit besotted only because the Wizards have such a shot at this top pick. We came this close to getting Wemby. This darn close. We came this close to getting Zion or Ja. This close. And, you know, it's got to bounce our way at this point. And Cooper in D.C. would be amazing. I mean, and also Cooper, you know, like, I have no idea what the dude's politics are. If he comes to D.C. and he's hanging out with, like, Melania, that would be a huge bummer. But, you know, I have a different kind of feeling that he's a good dude, even though he wears that Duke uniform. I know I'm projecting that 1,000%, but just everybody who's around him is like, yeah, this dude's a badass. Like, he beat Bradley Beal in one-on-one when he was 16 at a basketball camp.
If he comes to D.C., Dave, hopefully you can turn him socialist.
Cooper red flag. Oh, man.
You're uniquely positioned.
I'm uniquely positioned.
Fingers crossed.
Man, at my age, Shiraz, I might get within 50 yards with him and be violating some sort of restraining order with regards to interaction with minors. Who the hell knows? And who knows if it'll be against the law to talk to Cooper Flagg by next year. That all sorts of executive orders have been coming our way.
It might be supporting terrorism if you try.
Hey, man, these days it seems like just ordering the halal chicken is supporting terrorism. So there we go.
Thank you for doing that, though.
Yeah, no problem. Disappearing people is the new freedom fries. That's what I've decided. It's for idiots to get excited about. Well, that's all the time we have this week. Shiraz, so great to talk to you, man. This was as fun as I had dreamed it would be.
Likewise, thank you for including me in this conversation.
It was wonderful, and we barely even touched on Denny Crum. Well, sorry. So, yo, everybody out there, thanks so much for listening. Thanks so much for Michael Messner at the top of the show. Thank you so much, Shirazi. Listen to the last week's show where I talked to the great Rabbi Brant Rosen. I know that doesn't sound very sports and politicky, but dude brings it, and it's what you need to hear right now. For everybody out there listening, please stay frosty. We are out of here. Peace.